Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The headline is that newspapers, as we know them, are dying. Or choose your own word, bankruptcy, meltdown, collapse, morph. Across the country, they're shrinking, moving online. Some may just plain disappear and not be back, at least not in their current form. So what comes next? Can web-only editions and tiny newsrooms provide the serious, vigilant journalism we need to keep everybody honest? And where will the money come from? This hour On Point, the future of the news as newspapers hit the wall. You can join the conversation. Have you already canceled your subscription to your town or city's daily? Do you see a future for the newspaper as we know it? And what steps up if newspapers go down? Joining me now from New York is Jay Rosen. He's professor of journalism at New York University, author of the Press Think blog, where he writes about the future of the press. He is author of the book Why Journalists Matter. Jay Rosen, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Great to have you. And with us from New York is David Folkenflik. He is media reporter for NPR and just completed a two-part series on the future of newspapers. David Folkenflik, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much.
David, take us in here first. And I should say right off the bat, I love newspapers. I've always loved newspapers. I came up in newspapers, have worked for them all over the world. I hope they survive and thrive, but look around. It's pretty desolate out there. David, give us the news. Just what is practically happening to which newspapers, where? What are the sort of highlights of this meltdown we see?
Well, you really know how to hurt a recovering newspaper man, don't you?
Sorry. Yeah. I'm in the same
boat. If you look throughout the country, there's are problems both in the clinical term structural and cyclical. Bad things are happening to the newspaper newspapers because bad things are happening to the structure of the finance of newspapers, and bad things are happening because, of course, the wider economy. If you look in cities like Seattle, as Jay and I were talking about before the show, if you look at newspapers in Denver and Detroit, those are two newspaper towns, but you're seeing that in Seattle and Denver, you're seeing strong signs that the weaker paper will just go away and that the supposedly stronger dominant paper is itself somewhat on shaky grounds. In Detroit, they're trying a new approach where they're saying we're not even going to deliver 7 days a week. We'll deliver most days of the week, but it's too expensive for us and not worth it to us on our weaker days. I think there were really two benchmarks if you look towards the latter part of last year, too, that really got my attention. Mm. I think the broader public's attention, although, you know, this really is a topic that's been talked about for years inside the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But two things that, to me, that were signposts that are worth noting, one of which was on a single day, the privately owned New York Star-Ledger, owned by the Advance Company, bought out 40% of its staff. Goodbye. That is a tremendous culling of staff. This is, you know, privately held, so they don't have the pressures of shareholders. But they said, we can't afford this anymore. Similarly, my old employer, the Tribune Company, owner of some of the proudest brands anyway in print journalism, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun.
And Arts bankrupt.
Current, has filed for bankruptcy protection. Now, you can argue, look, if you look at airlines and other places, there are ways in which these companies that have had troubled finances have emerged stronger as a result of this. And it certainly was the case that the guy who took over the Tribune Company, real estate magnate Sam Zell, had burdened it with an unconscionable level of debt, in a sense. However, that said, you're having these major newspapers that serve these major metro markets, and their finances are in a very different state than they were just a few years ago. Major newspapers in Boston, in Atlanta, you know, are actually acknowledging they are they are losing money every week. San Francisco, the San Francisco Chronicle, losing $1 million a week, more or less. These are huge and troubling times. Not so in every market, not so for every paper, not so in every circumstance. But, you know, you're not wrong in your rather alarmist introduction to this show.
Well, it's alarming. Jay Rosen, look across this landscape with us. I mean, here's the news just today. Even Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation announcing a $6.4 billion loss in its fiscal year's second quarter. You can't keep that kind of loss up for very long. Are we going to see American towns and cities without a local newspaper, Jay?
It's quite possible. The collapse of the newspaper economy is something that's happening for specific reasons. I think we can only understand it, Tom, if we go back to the newspaper as an industrial marvel, which is what it was when it was great. The newspaper, the daily newspaper, was one of the paradigm examples of a fantastic act of modern coordination in which all these different parts worked over the course of 24 hours to gather the world together, produce an image of it, print it up, put it in trucks, and deliver it with advertising on homes all across the metropolitan area. It was an amazing thing. And what was great about the newspaper is that it was perfectly adapted to the communication system we had at that time. And now we have a different infrastructure. We have a different highway system for people. And there are a lot of other ways, easier ways to do what the newspaper did. And what it did pretty good for a mass audience is now done very well for micro audiences. And so the particular bundling of things that made the newspaper an industrial marvel, as well as a gold mine, as well as a monopoly franchise, as well as a lazy oligarchy for a long, long time, it just finally has fallen apart. And the new model has not arisen. So that is a perilous condition. So we see the equivalent of giant glaciers falling into the ocean in newsland because this model has finally given out. However, if we look at the whole picture, we also see new resources coming online. And so I like to think not about the decline of the newspaper only, but the general state of what I would call the verification troops, all of the people in society who are trying to find out what happened and verify it and make it trustable. All the people who are trying to do that, whatever we call them, we need them. And the newspaper was the way a lot of them made a living. We had permanent professional verification troops. Well, we don't know if that model will go on, but we need as a society to create it. And I think it will go on because in the long run, and I'll wind up, in the long vision, 300-year view of the press, what you see is the press, the idea of a free press, informing a free people, goes on in and out of different economies. In and out of different technologies or machines, right?
Right.
And keeps on going. And I believe it will, Tom. That's why we're here.
And now, Jay Rosen, you've said the press is on a forced migration to where exactly? We're not sure how successful they'll be. We're not sure.
Right.
David Folkenflik, that industrial marvel was certainly a marvel. The big pounding presses, it was thrilling to be part of it. And that, with all its profitability in the 20th century for a long time, gone. You've been out looking at what... imagining what happens if it goes away into this unformed new arena that Jay describes. And clearly a lot of new stuff is coming up. But in the interim, David, what does it look like? If you don't have a big, healthy, 20th century style newspaper, what happens to a town, to a city, to its understanding of itself and what's going on?
Well, that's right. You know, I was wrestling with this very question and decided to sort of take it head on. So I spent a couple of days in the city of Hartford, Connecticut, a city that has been served in, you know, since, I believe, 1764 by one form or another of the Hartford Courant.
Oldest paper in the country.
Oldest continuously publishing newspaper in the country.
Good,
and
good.
I'm sure there's a reason why it's qualified
that way. Right, okay.
But, you know, it goes back to the old New England Courant. You know, you're talking a newspaper older than the Declaration of Independence, a city that is home to three of the nation's largest corporations, a city that is the seat of state government, a city, you know, basically right smack in the middle of Boston and New York on that, you know, famous corridor, in a state that was served by also the Globe and the Times for many years in different ways.
Corrupt governors.
It's got a real culture of corruption there. It is a very poor city in a very rich state, and it's a place where you would think that watchdog and community journalism would be welcome and necessary. And the Courant has, you know, if you think of recent decades, really provided that. It has been one of those papers, originally an independent paper, but particularly under the ownership of Times Mirror, which was the old parent company for the Los Angeles Times. It really grew and thrived.
And as Jay suggests, they lifted the rocks. They found when there was corruption, they went after it.
They absolutely did. They swung way above their weight class. Mm-hmm. They were very competitive. They were sort of the defining media outlet, not the only, but the defining media outlet for state politics. They found corruption. They were ahead of when former Governor Roland was and members of his administration were acting in ways that were personally corrupt. Their stories helped shine a rather intense light on that. You know, the mayor of Hartford was just indicted on corruption charges, and they've been reporting on issues related to those incidents for several years.
And it's still there. It hasn't gone away, and you were very careful to say that, but you looked at what would happen if it did. What happens to journalism in a city like that?
Well, you know, there will be things that arise, as Jay suggests, even in the near term. You're seeing little blogs percolate and pop up, but, you know, they're mostly one- or two-person bands at the moment. You know, when you're talking to the Hartford Courant, you know, in the last decade has lost almost half of its staff, and it is a much thinner read than it used to be. It is not necessarily the paper it was a decade ago, and for all that, it is still the paper that's letting people know about regional culture and theater, knowing people about issues affecting teacher pay, about troubles with charter schools, or about the promise of new programs for, you know, inmates in the state jails. This is still the paper that is sort of a commons where people can go and have some sort of shared understanding of what the issues confronting their communities, their state is. I talked to the House Speaker. It was a very interesting conversation. And the Speaker of the House said, look, they ding me periodically, and, you know, I think sometimes it's cheap shots. But, you know, for all that, this is the forum where we get to play out ideas, where we get to, you know, if somebody suggests something in a committee meeting in the General Assembly and it gets picked up and talked about on the opinion pages, this is where people go to learn more about that and to argue about it. And I thought that was a very interesting insight. I think that's true on the news pages. I think that's true often for people in the opinion pages as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American newspapers hitting the wall and what comes next for the news. Jay Rosen is here, professor of journalism at New York University, author of What Are Journalists For? And NPR's media reporter David Folkenflik is here, a longtime newspaper guy himself. We're going to look very local at smaller cities and towns, but I want to think big here for a second, Jay, up at the level of the biggest papers. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. There was a rash of talk just recently about the need for philanthropists to step in and endow newspapers, put up $5 billion, maybe Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, so that the New York Times might live off its endowment. Or Steve Cole, formerly at the Washington Post, saying $2 billion, and you can have the Washington Post in all its glory more or less forever. Has it come to that, Jay? Is it a good idea, bad idea, what?
Well, as David mentioned, the crisis in the newspaper business model is not a secret. It's been known by people who study the industry for
sure,
quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not simply that the internet has come and people moved there and they don't pay for newspapers and the online revenue isn't there. It's really a deeper thing. It has to do with the transformation of advertising itself as it becomes more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been able to play out the scenario for a while, not knowing exactly when things would happen, but that the model was in trouble. And one of the things that I always thought would happen sort of near at the end game is that big, important battleship institutions like the New York Times and the Washington Post would start looking for rich people, you know, to buy them because they had run out of other options, because that would be the last thing that the Sulzberger family would want to do. But before they expire, they would definitely – and I always thought it might be attractive to somebody because the New York Times is an amazing property. You know, it's like owning a castle or owning the moon or something. So we always figured somebody would
right. –
and that was like a scenario in the future. It's not in the future anymore.
They've already turned to Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim, not to buy them exactly, but to put
in
a big chunk of money at very, very punishing terms on loan, and could end up with a big chunk of it.
Right. And then the endowment thing interested me for a couple of reasons. First of all, if the Washington Post can get Warren Buffett to turn over $2 billion and like stabilize itself, I would say that's probably a good thing.
He's on the board there.
But, yeah, he's on the board. But I bet you Warren Buffett's going to say, well, wait a minute. I'm not going to give you a couple of billion dollars until I see how you're going to be sustainable. And that gets right back to the business model. So nobody's going to put that kind of money in. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, has said he agrees with us that the newspaper's loss would be major, not just for society, but for Google. They know that. But they're not about to put money into the newspaper until they can see what the plan is. And we are between models. We are between solutions. And that is why you have these. Now, it's good that people are thinking out of left field. We got an investment advisor to Yale, the person who runs their portfolio, thinking about the newspaper.
David Swensen writing they should be bailed out by philanthropists and set up in perpetuity.
What's good about that is that we actually need lots of new knowledge on this problem. We need people who haven't been a part of a failing industry, frankly, to come in and start thinking about producing the capacity for news in places where the newspaper declines. But I have to say one other thing, Tom, which is in some communities, it's actually fine. The newspaper is a profitable concern. It doesn't have to make 20%. It is the best advertiser by far in the community. Mm-hmm. It does serve a local need. There is a range of towns where the newspaper is actually thriving and probably might be able to make this transition. So we have to keep that in mind.
Right, right.
It's certain metro areas where it's a crisis.
David Falkenflik, it's maybe unfair to ask the NPR media reporter about this philanthropy point because, of course, NPR survives in very significant part on the philanthropy from some very large donors and millions of small ones. But what about for newspapers? What have you heard about this possibility? I don't know that there's a philanthropist out there for every newspaper, but as Jay says, they may not all need them. But for the big ones, is that something that works or is that like endowing buggy makers forever?
Well, you know, it's interesting you raised the issue of buggy makers. For a piece I did that ran Friday, it was about the not-for-profit model. And there are different kinds of not-for-profit models. There's the Yale University. You've got a huge endowment and you charge a little tuition on the side. There's also the not-for-profit model of, for example, local public radio stations. So, for example, I spoke with a guy named Peter Osnos, who's a former commentator on Morning Edition, but more to the point, journalist for The Washington Post, who's also a book publisher. And, you know, he argues that the public radio model may provide the best hope, and that is you've got several legs on which to build a foundation. You would have readers, what we might call, I don't know, listeners who might contribute to their local news outlet. You would be winning local grants and you'd be getting some sort of underwriting, what for-profit people would call advertising from corporate sponsors. And you see this happen in a number of websites in particular. I know that we're going to have other voices later in this in this hour, but things like the New Haven Independent and the Minnesota Post and Voice of San Diego, where there is that sort of three-legged structure. Osnos says, look, it's great. I did in part my piece based on a profile of this group called ProPublica, which is this not-for-profit investigative news outlet, which essentially shares its work for free with news outlets across the country from, you know, smaller papers like the Albany Times Union to the New York Times. You know, they're looking for partners everywhere, outlets for their investigative journalism, and they don't charge a dime.
But you really build the industrial marvel Jay talks about, that sort of big metro or big local paper even that covers everything soup to nuts on that kind of basis? Or do you need to anymore?
To be honest, I don't think that that's being created anymore. I think that people are trying to figure out a way to sustain the large metro dailies that
or
you see
sustain,
with varying degrees of luck. You know, something like ProPublica was born by a commitment of up to $10 million a year for each of the next 3 years from this wealthy couple, the Sandlers, who are philanthropists. That's a different model. That's also a very tight, lean little newsroom. You're talking about maybe 24, 27 journalists in the room. You're not talking about, you know, a newsroom like the Baltimore Sun, my old employer, you know, at its peak had 400 journalists. Mm-hmm. It's a very differently sized and scaled enterprise. I think it's hubristic for me to say here's where it's going. But, it seems to me as though initiatives and experiments are bubbling up, some of which seem quite promising, some of which seem to me to be inadequate to the task of keeping citizens engaged, informed, illuminated, and excited about the cities and the towns and the country in which they live.
We've got more options to look at, but let's hear from some listeners first. Barrington, Rhode Island, and Christine. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about shenanigans that will be able to happen, not just political ones, but development ones as well. I have a local example. Rhode Island abuts Massachusetts right here. We have Narragansett Bay that goes up to Mount Hope Bay and also goes all the way up to Providence. When it goes up to Mount Hope Bay, it goes to Fall River. And we do need new energy, but a big LNG company wants to put in or wanted to put in a gigantic center very, very close to 9,000 families. A lot of people thought it was dangerously close. If this LNG center went in, it would go underneath three bridges because of Homeland Security. It would possibly interrupt people going back and forth across the bridges for work, emergency, whatever. Also, it would interrupt commercial fishing and regular boating.
And Christine, you're worried that without a newspaper to shine a light on this, it just goes ahead.
Already happened in the sense that the Providence Journal, at the time that the hearings first started with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Providence Journal at the time had these different regional editions. So I was in the East Bay. I was aware of the hearings that you could go to. People in Providence weren't. Some people in Providence, now that they don't have the editions anymore based on region, are reading the New York Times exclusively. And
and may not even know about the local situation. Christine, you raise a great case in point. Jay Rosen, I mean, here it is, the kind of nook and cranny, and not so small, that newspapers have as their bread and butter shone a light on for a long time. David Swenson, in his op-ed piece, quoted Thomas Jefferson, 1787, saying, were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate to prefer the latter. Christine's kind of on that boat, saying, if you don't have a newspaper shining a light in there, who's going to do it?
Well, first of all, Tom, what Jefferson said after that famous quote is that he would prefer newspapers without government, but what he meant was that everyone should get them and everyone should use them and everyone should be able to read them. And under those conditions, he preferred newspapers over government. So the journalists always leave that part out. And I think that's where you want to begin, because what the internet is making possible is people's participation in the news system. And the old newspaper was not only not optimized for participation, it was optimized the other way. It's a closed system. So some of those organizations
pay for it or you don't get it, in other words.
Are having trouble adapting, yes, are having trouble adapting. But someone has made an amazing photo essay out of abandoned desks and workspaces in the newsrooms of America. You could make a similarly haunting essay out of abandoned workspaces in state capitals and city halls around America, where there used to be a bustling press corps, definitely keeping an eye on the people in town and when they're deal-making. And that asset is now gone. And it is a very scary thing. And I've already seen reports like David's, but there's others who have gone in and looked at where the press used to be a force and seeing the devastation, as it were, and they've picked up from players in town. Well, yeah, I mean, people know that nobody's watching anymore. And I think that is the real. I think that has happened. And so we have to figure out as a society, as a community, we have to figure out, okay, how are we going to rebuild the surveillance as well as the verification troops? And I think those conversations, believe it or not, are starting to go on, where people in communities are looking across the space where the newspaper used to be.
The hole.
Yes. Then looking at each other across that space and trying to say, we got to organize ourselves somehow. There's a group in Chicago like this. I'm going to speak to one in Seattle like this. And I think we will see more of that. But it won't necessarily be how do we keep our local newspaper from going out of business.
But what do we do instead if it's not in business or not thriving in business? Let me go to Orchard Park, New York, and Ed. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to say that it's a great time for reading newspapers. I love reading particularly online versions of papers. And I love the fact that I can read multiple ones. You know, I can read the New York Times. I can go see what the Washington Post is talking about, or the Seattle Times on the other side of the country.
Do you pay for any of them, Ed? Do you pay for them?
No, I don't. I did want to say, though, that the advertising does work once in a while. I mean, if I want to see a movie, I'll often go and read a review on the paper, or if I'm looking at cars or whatever, electronics.
Would you be willing to pay more online, since it appears newspapers can't support a full operation on the basis of online advertising? Would you be willing to pay a few cents per article or click when you're in a newspaper site, or would that just send you elsewhere?
At this point, it probably would send me elsewhere. I mean, the New York Times tried for a while to charge for some of its content, and I wasn't willing to go that route. I guess if I had to, I mean, if I didn't have other choices, then I probably would pay a subscription fee of some sort.
Ed, thanks for your call. David Folkenflik, tee off that if you would, because there it is in a nutshell. I mean, many people have observed when you count online readership, newspapers have never had more readers, and yet they don't pay. They don't have to pay in almost all cases. Ed says he might if he had to everywhere, but that's hard to organize. In the meantime, it's not paying the freight.
Well, the real problem is that advertisers aren't willing to pay as much to get a pair of eyeballs online as they are in print. You know, it's basically, call it pennies or dimes to the dollar, depending on how it is. So, you know, there was this like year and a half long initiative by the newspaper publisher association, I think called the NAA, to do the, called the Readership Project. They were going to let everybody know their readership's never been stronger. You know, Washington Post has, you know, it was at one time considered the model of what's called penetration, which is the percentage of people in a market who actually pay to subscribe to a newspaper. And in recent years, it's, you know, it's really tumbled downward at paid circulation levels. But, you know, if you take in combination their print and their online version, I mean, it's soaring. People all, as this gentleman from Orchard Park says, you know, people are hungry for their incredibly high caliber of national, international news. And the advertisers are saying, so what? You know, we're going to pay a little bit, but not a lot, you know. And, you know, local advertisers don't really particularly care about reaching national readers. It is a rich age. I mean, everything is ambiguous and mixed. You know, your previous caller from Rhode Island, she talked about those zoned editions where, you know, some people in one part of the state didn't know about the development. Online, now that the Providence Journal Bulletin has a website, which it wouldn't have 20 years ago, people throughout the state can, you know, with a few keystrokes, know for free, should they have, you know, internet access, about that development in a way they might not have with the rigorously zoned editions 20 years ago. So there is a trade-off. There is an opportunity for people to learn about things. I love the fact that, you know, I'm from Southern California. My Lakers beat LeBron James in Cleveland last night. And I love the fact I can go and just hop on the LATimes.com sports section and read all about it. And I don't have to have my dad and mom send it to me 3 days later, which is what they used to do when I was in college.
Jay, what about micropayments for that? I'm sorry, David, but Walter Isaacson, the former managing editor of Time Magazine, says we have to have people paying at least a few cents for the kind of information they get. Can you see that happening, Jay?
I'm not against it. I can see it happening. I don't think the problem is primarily technological. I do think that people should explore pay models of different kinds. I'm sure there will be some that work. But what I don't trust in the conversation is the way journalists assume that what they're doing now is sort of good enough for people to pay for. I think the only way pay models work is if they also figure out how to add more value, how to be more responsive, how to just be able to accomplish what they haven't been able to accomplish before.
And more value than they traditionally did on paper?
Yes, way more. Yeah.
People paid for the paper.
They have. Well, I'm telling you that if you're going to end up charging online where there is many different ways for people to find out what's going on, many different ways for them to gain their own understanding, that you're just going to have to add more value. And I think a lot of people who have been very successful under conditions of high barriers to entry don't realize what part of their success is due to that, and they are handicapped in this moment.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American newspapers hitting the wall and what comes next for the news. We're going to hear in just a moment from a nonprofit in San Diego that's mixing things up there. David Folkenflik has joined us. He's media reporter for NPR. Jay Rosen is here as well, professor of journalism at New York University. Let's get a call from Lincoln, Nebraska. And Sue, hi, Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm happy we get your show now out of Omaha.
That's great.
My comment is that I canceled our subscription to the newspaper a couple of years ago because I was getting tired of the editorial tack. It's very conservative, and there wasn't much balance in that regard. And I'm East Coast bred and educated, and it was a little bit of a shock to me how different it is here that way. And
so it was the editorials were too conservative for you? Where do you get your news now then, Sue?
I'm sorry, but I really have a bad connection hearing you.
I'm sorry for that, but we appreciate your call, and thanks for being there. We'll pick that up. Let me get one more here first from Buffalo, New York. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. How are you doing, Tom?
Good.
Good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear. What are you thinking, Michael?
Very good. Well, two words come to mind when we talk about journalism as far as newspapers and now online. The two words I'm thinking about are paradigm shift. Now, also, there has to be an honesty when it comes to a conversion from, let's say, from newspapers to online. Not saying that newspapers are going to be completely done away with, but there has to be a serious honesty. You know, when you think about these people that have blogs and things of that nature.
So what matters? If papers go and you rely more on the web, what do you gain? What do you lose, Michael?
Well, there are definitely pros and cons with everything that comes along, including things that switch from one thing to another. One of the things we do definitely gain is that if there are journalists who decide to carry over to what they do, and if they are able to keep a lot of different things like you would normally with a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
You know, you have a lot more journalists getting the information, you know, being able to convey it a lot faster, you know, as you would outside of a newspaper, because myself personally, I've been able to get the news from one form online a lot faster in some cases, you know, rather than I would through a newspaper.
What about newspaper writing, the kind of big feature takeouts that we used to know in the newspapers? Do you get those? Do you read those online, Michael?
Not exactly. As far as critics, I don't, like, especially for movies, I would say I'm much like everyone else. If I like the movie, I'll go see it. If I don't like it, I can wait for it. But it's definitely, as far as the journalism, it definitely is everything stepping itself up a level. So as it was said with the journalist
mm-hmm.
earlier, you know, things really do have to step up. Various levels. Now, like you said before, there are going to be some things that are going to pass and be like a pass-fail basis. They're going to really be on an upswing. Like, for example, MySpace and other such social sites have really boomed. You know, and when the conditions
right.
are right.
But of course, it's not exactly journalism there. But it sounds like you're one of those who's ready to migrate if the right product is there. And Michael, let me get one more call here from Hartford, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Gentlemen, best wishes.
Hi.
Throw this one into the quote mix, unquote. A number of local radio talk show hosts claim that the real problem the newspapers are having, particularly the Hartford Current, is that they're way too left of center, almost socialist, and the readers are therefore turned off, and that their even so-called legitimate straight reporting is influenced by their leftward leanings.
So here's the other side. You heard Sue in Lincoln, Nebraska saying it's too conservative.
Well, it's not just the local talk show people, but some of the national people are saying the same thing. It's not the matter of lack of advertising. It's the readership is up in arms over the
politics of the papers. Let us pick that up, Mark. Jay Rosen, what about it? The politics of papers, do you think that's a big deal here and what's happening with their fortunes?
I think the way to approach it so that both callers make sense instead of canceling each other out
mm-hmm.
is that the consensus narrative that newspapers were able to put over for a long time as the mass medium that kind of won out over a certain period has simply collapsed, and it's not convincing to people anymore.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what did the daily metropolitan newspaper that bestrode his community, like the Philadelphia Inquirer, what was it made of? It was made of conquest over a dozen earlier newspapers, all of which represented points of view, and became a monopoly product. So mm-hmm. when it does that, it absorbs all of those readers, and it gives them something. You could say it's homogenized, but it's intended to appeal to all. And the kind of approximating that goes on becomes a formula after a while. So if that consensus narrative, as I just called mm-hmm, it, mm-hmm. collapses, if it's not convincing anymore, if it doesn't register, then lots of people will begin to express their dissatisfaction with it. Now, that condition can go on for a while, but if the internet comes along and suddenly all those people can hook up with each other,
those silos of uniform opinion.
Yes, they're not going to just stay silent about it, right? So then the journalist had this sense, oh, we're besieged, when actually their whole narrative has fallen apart. And part of the reason is that it wasn't really good at anything. It just wasn't really bad at anything either. It wasn't too offensive and it wasn't too daring. And now people want more and they don't agree with the newspaper, and they don't feel represented by it, and they definitely don't feel that it's their newspaper.
Though when it was good at investigation, it could be very important indeed. I want to go to California, San Diego, and a new example of the kind of nonprofit, smaller vehicles that are popping up here. Andrew Donahue is with us. He's co-executive director of the nonprofit investigative newspaper, The Voice of San Diego. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So I'm reading about you guys here. You're not a regular old-fashioned paper. What do you do?
We are not. We are actually, today's our 4-year anniversary. We're a nonprofit.
Happy anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
4 years is not nothing.
Nonprofit, online-only investigative reporting about local quality of life issues.
So are you only investigative stuff? When I pick you up, I'm not going to read about the movies or the local play or sports results?
No. We're never going to try to be what the newspaper was, the sort of general accumulation of things. We do, we're updating throughout the day, so not everything is the long investigative pieces, but a lot of hard enterprise beat reporting, in-depth analysis.
Are you mainly online, Andrew, or paper, both?
We are only online.
Only online. And you've got a newspaper there, don't you? The San Diego Union Tribune? What's the problem?
We do. We were born directly out of a dissatisfaction with the newspaper. A small group of our residents here, philanthropists, had always wanted more from the newspaper. However, the barriers had always been too high. It always was too expensive to build, to buy the printing press and distribute the paper and buy the ink and all that sort of stuff. So
they put you up and you've found jimmied statistics from the police chief and other things you've uncovered. Who's paying the freight?
This is a sort of a wide effort. We have a small handful of large donors. We also get grants from organizations like the Knight Foundation, national organizations. We get grants from local organizations. We also have 800 just individual donors. Those are everybody down the street in San Diego, from $35 to $1,000 a year. And then we also do a little bit of a hybrid. We also have online advertising as well.
What about the size of your staff? We heard earlier David Folkenflik was talking about the old days in Baltimore, 400. What about you there in San Diego?
Yeah, we have a staff of 11, but that's up from a staff of 4 when we first started. And, we don't ever think we need to be the size of what the old newspaper was, because we don't ever want to do the things like the movie critiques or the car shows or anything like that. What we want to do is the key quality of life issues. And, we could have tried to start to be bigger, but we wanted to slowly grow this thing, safely, conservatively, and organically. So I think we'll keep going along that path. But right now it doesn't take all that much when you've got an efficient vehicle like the web and a bunch of experienced but hardworking reporters whose only mission it is to go out there and get investigative stories.
Andrew, hang on. I want to get a call from Pennsylvania here. Perkasie, Pennsylvania. And Ian. Hi, Ian. You're on the air. What do you see in your local situation?
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, Perkasie is a relatively small town. And what I see just amongst the people I know is just a real lack of just civil interest and civic. And, you know, people get caught up in these huge national and international events, the stimulus package or the war in Iraq, because they simply just, maybe read the larger news services like BBC Online or...
Ian, do you have a local newspaper keeping your local government honest? Do you have that in your town?
No, not anymore. We sold our business. And, I mean, it's gotten to the point now where, I mean, the local governments in my area can get away with almost anything.
What's the population of Perkasie?
It's about 15,000.
15,000. All right, let's take that, if I may, to the Voice of San Diego and Andrew Donahue. Andrew, do you have a model that could work for little Perkasie there with 15,000 people?
Yeah, I think we're starting to get calls, emails, visits from people, you know, 3 or 4 times a week from cities large and small throughout the United States and throughout the country who are looking to start publications like these. Like I said, they're tremendously efficient. You don't need a whole lot of money to run them, certainly not what you needed from a newspaper. And I think the point the caller made is a salient one for a lot of cities right now, in that a lot of the, you know, these regional big city newspapers focused so much on national events and issues outside of their realm because they wanted to be sort of the big commanding paper of the region, that they've forgotten to focus on what's actually really going on in their community, and they forgot to do the one thing that they could do better than anybody else, and that's actually cover their own city.
Let's get a call from Lexington, Massachusetts, and Margaret. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that I am somebody who did pay the New York Times, I think for 2 years, their website. And, I was rather surprised when they started giving it for free. They did allow me to read some stories online for no cost, but then if I wanted to read opinions or go back and read yesterday's paper, that's when the cost kicked in. And it, to me, it seemed fair. The price that they were charging seemed fair. And I understand that I'm paying for content just the way, I mean, I'm a donor to WBUR.
Public radio,
yeah. Paying for the content.
Right. What if it was a Voice of San Diego style investigative print product in your neighborhood, Margaret? Would you chip in, or do you think most people
would? We get the local paper delivered. We also get the Boston Globe delivered.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not somebody who reads things cover to cover, but I would feel so isolated and frankly kind of frightened if I didn't feel that I had access to information.
No kidding, and you're willing to pay for it. David Falkenflik, what about it? Margaret's willing to stand up, sounds like, it in a multimedia posture to pay for her news, but are there enough like her out there to keep the news flowing in the way that we've understood it and come to expect it, David?
I mean, I think on the whole, people are paying for it with internet access fees, but they're paying for the people who are providing the, former Senator Stevens might say, the tubes through which they're delivered rather than the
newsroom
conjuring up the work. You know, people are willing to pay for all kinds of things if they think it's of value. You know, The Economist costs a fair amount of money. Mm-hmm. The Economist has done very well in the United States. It's really grown. People, are... But that's a tough business, and in some ways that's an outlier. I've got to say that it's hard to get people to pay for something they're not used to. If they experience the collapse of needed news and I'm not saying this is the case, but if in San Diego the paper were to go away, I imagine a lot of people would be willing to voluntarily hand over more money to Voice of San Diego. I think people, I think, as Jay says, we're in a space between points where we don't know exactly what the funding models are going to be, and we don't know what that will sustain. what it will allow to exist. It's not simply that we don't know how the money will get there. It's that we don't know what the money is entirely supposed to support. So you've got two variables in an equation, and that makes for a very uncertain time.
Tom,
yes, Jay.
When we talk about local news, we have to also consider this part of it. I would pay money for somebody to tell me consistently about the renovation of Washington Square Park, which is outside my door. I can't get any news about that, not anywhere near what I want.
And it's right outside your door, but there's how many people abut the park? Enough to employ a journalist?
Okay. Here's my point. Mm-hmm. I think there is demand for local news that is really about your world, your life, your school, your park. And the Metro News Organization has never actually tried to reach down to that level.
Well, some but if have.
Demand,
regional,
but if demand
regional,
is at that, mm-hmm. no way, no, mm-hmm. not to that level.
But let me just say,
I think that's where demand lies.
But I also have got to say that is in some ways the most expensive reporting to be done.
It's not going to be done by those organizations.
That's
it's going
right.
to be done by a combination of networks and volunteers and people organized to inform each other. And we have to look at the emergence of those networks because the future of news lies there as well.
Wow. That's a new picture. Everybody chipping in, not necessarily paying for all the news, but everybody chipping in to figure it out in total. Andrew Donahue, do you think you've found the way? Do you think it could be replicated in other cities and towns? Do you think it will? Or is this just one more facet of a new scene coming up?
I don't think we have the answer. I don't think – obviously nobody has the answer right now. What I think right now has to happen is as many different kinds of things need to be tried. Journalism's been lacking a certain level of innovation and entrepreneurship for a long time, and this is sort of our time to figure out where our industry is going. So there needs to be plenty of more Voice of San Diego's tried around town and around cities throughout the country, but there also needs to be a million other things thought of, too.
Well, we wish
right
you
on,
luck.
Andrew.
Right on comes the message from Falcon, Flick, and Rosen. Andrew Donahue at Voice of San Diego, good luck to you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jay Rosen at NYU, thank you so much for your time. Fascinating picture out there. We wish everybody luck in it. Jay, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And David Falcon, Flick with NPR. David, great to have you.
You bet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.